Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome everyone. Imagine that you're running late and stuck in a traffic jam, which I'm sure happens pretty often, right? And instead of getting tense and irritated, you remain peaceful and calm. Or imagine that your new boss, a very demanding new boss, says that it's his way or the highway. And instead of feeling intimidated or angry, you feel compassion. Well, Dr. Judith Orloff says that's entirely possible. She's passionate in her knowledge that we each have the power to transform negative emotions and achieve inner peace. I had the opportunity of talking with her a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to bring you a pre-recorded session with her. She's actually coming up to Seattle later in March, and we'll announce that at the end of this segment if you want to see her. But we had the opportunity of talking with her, and let me give her a formal introduction, and then we'll play the recording. So Dr. Orloff synthesizes traditional medicine with cutting-edge knowledge of intuition, energy, and spirituality. She's a board-certified psychiatrist and assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA. Dr. Orloff's work has been featured just about everywhere in O Magazine, Self, Cosmo, The Washington Times, The New York Post. She's a blogger for Psychology Today, and she's appeared on The Today Show, CBS Early Show, CNN, PBS, and NPR, to name a few. In addition, Dr. Orloff has written a trilogy of best-selling books. Positive Energy was one of them, Guide to Intuitive Healing another, and Second Sight, her third. And each of those explore new breakthroughs in intuition, energy, and how to combat the epidemic of exhaustion overtaking our world. Her new book is called Emotional Freedom, and that's what we're focusing on today. Dr. Judith Orloff, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So your new book is called Emotional Freedom, Liberate Yourself from Negative Emotions and Transform Your Life. And what a lot of really great information there is in here. I was telling you before the program started.
Oh, well, thank you. I wanted to kind of present a guide for how to get through challenging times and to deal with whatever emotion comes up, whether it's fear, worry, anger, frustration, depression, how to transform these emotions into something more positive, and to see emotions as a path to spiritual and intuitive awakening rather than just something that is annoying or something or an emotion to get rid of.
And that's what you mean by emotional freedom, right?
Oh, yeah. So emotional freedom is increasing your ability to love by cultivating positive emotions and being able to compassionately witness and transform negative ones. So it brings a certain mindfulness to the experience of this energy we call emotions. And this fundamental living skill liberates you from fear mm-hmm. and lets you navigate adversity without going on the attack or being derailed by the negativity. And so the premise of emotional freedom is that we all need to commit to not leading a fear-driven life and do everything possible not to be seduced by that powerful energy of fear. Can you imagine if we all joined together and made that commitment?
I was just going to say, could you imagine what the world would be like if we all did that exactly?
But we must. I mean, that's the message of the book. We must. We have no more time to waste, and now is the time.
You say we must respect the voice within each of us that says, be kind to yourself. You're enough as you are. You are beautiful. You go on to say this compassion is in each of us. It's the ultimate answer. And it's the one that you aspire to teach your patients. Tell us why. And tell us, you know, some people don't have that voice in them.
The compassionate voice?
Yeah, some people don't have that compassionate voice. And it's a case of finding it, right?
Oh, it's the case of devoting your life to find it. It's the most powerful force within us that we must find self-compassion as we're leading life, because so much happens to us in life. And whatever happens, we need to show ourselves mercy and show ourselves self-compassion. I mean, I know as a psychiatrist working with patients and also just knowing people that most of the time we beat ourselves up in our own heads. And spiritual progress, to me, is beating yourself up a little bit less each day.
So, that's good. So we don't have to make a rapid change overnight if we can't do that. Gradual is good, as long as we're going in the right direction.
Oh, you know, the premise of emotional freedom is that baby steps are the most beautiful ones. And I've really had it with epiphanies, these life-changing ahas, mm-hmm. you know, that come along every now and then, and they're great. But for real emotional freedom and to liberate yourself in the moment, you must really celebrate the small victories, and every little thing builds light. If there is no light in the world, you make it. You know, that's our responsibility. We can make the light, even if there is total darkness. And for everyone listening, don't think that you can't. Just taking a step towards self-compassion or love or service creates that light, and it begins to generate it in the world. But people are so intimidated when the lights go out and it's dark. People
right.
get scared, and I understand that. But part of emotional freedom is knowing you have the light within you by being able to make that shift from fear into faith or service or trusting your intuition instead of what everyone else in the world is telling you to do.
Mm. And one thing I really noticed about your book, compared with a lot of books that talk on similar kind of topics, is that you shared your personal experiences, even as a psychiatrist. I mean, you still walk through the same shadows that other people walk through. And I think sharing those really helps to show how you can step through to that light that you're talking about.
Oh, yes. With each chapter where I talk about transformation, such as how to transform fear with courage, how to transform frustration with patience, how to transform anger with compassion, I bring in my own experiences as well, because we're all on this path together in terms of this is a spiritual experience we're going through here on Earth, and part of our job description is to learn how to transform negativity, and that includes me. That includes everybody. And so I'm very happy to share my own challenges and struggles and triumphs with the various emotions. And I consider myself a student of intuition and emotional freedom, because each day there's something new, you know,
right.
which the good news is keeps you passionate and keeps everything exciting. Now, the bad news is that it sometimes takes effort to stretch the soul, and the linear mind can say, oh, no, can't you just let up? No, you know, not one more thing.
You say at the beginning of the book that our intellect has limited vision regarding emotions, but that we can go deeper within by bringing intuition, that you just talked about intuition. We can go deeper by bringing intuition into the feeling realm. Explain to me what you mean by that.
Well, what I mean by that is when you feel depressed, on the surface, it seems like it's just misery. But if you tune in with intuition, the inner vision that lets you see the true meaning in things, what this can do is shine a light in the darkness and let you see that depression, what lessons depression can bring you. I present depression as a spiritual dark night of the soul for everyone. It needs to be dignified. It needs to be made sacred, the kind of difficult journeys we all take within. And intuition lets you know the truth of that very deeply. You know, it lets you know that even though it's painful and difficult, there is something, a pearl, a gem in here for you. And that allows you to have hope. So intuition is very important when you're dealing with anything emotional, so you can go deeper than the surface experience and see the deeper meaning in it. And you feel the way you feel intuition, you get an aha, you get goosebumps that run up and down you, you get the hair on the back of your neck stands on end, you get, yes, there is meaning here. You can feel it in your body, not just in your head. Your head can't totally understand the whole emotional world.
Right, right. Now, the book is divided into two parts. Part one is tapping the power of emotional freedom, and part two, your tools for liberation. So I'd like to look at part one, first of all. You say there are four components of emotion: biology, spirituality, energetic power, and psychology. And you say that we need to understand each component within ourselves. And if we do, when we do understand it, it will lead to inner breakthroughs that aren't possible without seeing that whole picture. So I'd like to look at each of the four components. And biology, I think most of us are familiar with that flight or fight syndrome caused by stress. We need to get our endorphins flowing, right?
Yes. And take charge of our biology instead of just having the fight or flight response with your stress hormones flowing and that constricting your blood vessels and causing acid reflux and tensing your muscles and all kinds of reactions. You can take control by using some of the techniques in the book, breathing, centering, coming back to yourself, not letting your biology get out of control. It's not as if it just happened. You have an active role in what your body is doing and tuning into it and saying no to certain biochemical responses is really empowering.
Now, number two, the second component of emotion is spirituality. How do we uncover the spiritual meaning of our emotions? What do you mean by that?
Well, I believe that there is a purpose and a greater meaning of every emotion that we go through. And the point of the difficult emotions is to stretch or flex our spiritual muscles so that we can grow stronger and learn how to transform what is negative in us so we're not so tweaked by it, so we're not so thrown off by it, to really gain charge of how we respond to negative emotions and see the transformation of emotions that I talk about in the book, from fear into courage, from anger into compassion, as a light-bearing spiritual act, which it is. As a psychiatrist, people have come to me and they've said, oh, I wish I could be coming to you with something more spiritual, but all I have is a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is the essence of spirituality. That is the nitty-gritty. That's where you start. All right, what are you panicked about? Where is it in your body? What is your intuition telling you about it? And how can you transform it so it doesn't plague you? And that is light-bearing, and that, to me, is a sacred spiritual transformation. And as a psychiatrist, I present emotions as the path to spiritual transformation with all my patients, because if you don't, there's no way to understand it simply biologically or even psychologically, because it diminishes the experience.
Now, is that a common practice among psychiatrists? I don't think it is, right?
No.
And I read that you come from a family of 25 physicians. So, you know, how does that all fit in?
That's funny. No, unfortunately, most psychiatrists don't talk about spirituality with their patients. Or, you know, at UCLA, where I'm assistant clinical professor of psychiatry, it's very rarely ever brought up. And during my medical training, when I went through USC and UCLA, I never once heard it, nor did I ever hear, well, what does your intuition tell you about this patient? That's why I wrote this book, because I want psychiatry and mental health to expand, to include traditional medicine, but also bring in a spiritual framework, an energetic framework, and a psychological framework to widen our definition of our experiences so that we don't just look at it as a biochemical response that needs to be corrected with medication.
Right. Makes sense. Now, number three, the third component of emotion is energetic power. And you say that in energy psychiatry, you've learned to see emotions as a stunning expression of energy. Tell us what you mean by that.
Oh, yes. A real travesty in traditional medicine is they don't consider the subtle energetic component of behavior and feeling. And we have these subtle energy fields that run in our body, that run through our body and expand beyond our body to create an energy field, an aura. And how we interrelate with others energetically affects us day in and day out. For instance, part of the book I talk about what is your emotional type. And one of the emotional types is an emotional empath. And these are sponges, people who can sponge up energy and absorb it into their bodies, as I can. This is my emotional type. And this affects them profoundly in terms of depression, anxiety. They don't know where it comes from. They're just absorbing the emotions of people around them, but have no idea that they're doing that or how to stop it. And so the energy of emotions can impact our bodies in very powerful ways. Therefore, we need to know how to work with emotions energetically and bring in the good ones and transform the ones that are not healthy for us.
Okay. I want to go into that a little bit more in detail just a little later in the show. Let's just first of all look at the psychology, which is the fourth component of emotion. And let's look at how we map the psychology of emotions, why we feel what we feel, and which emotional styles hinder or serve us.
Yes, exactly. Well, psychology is the study of human behavior, and there are a number of amazing psychological techniques that you can use with your emotions, you know, including looking back at your past and finding out where the emotion of shame or depression or anxiety came from. It means going back to your parents, and I'm a big believer in this, and looking at their strong points and their weak points so that you don't keep repeating patterns that your parents brought in and that you unconsciously repeat in your relationships or your life. And so, you know, I encourage patients to go back and look at their parents, you know, and you see the good, bad, and the ugly. You see everything.
Mm.
And, you know, as Ram Dass says, you know, it's one of the most spiritual experiences you can have. It's just go visit your parents for a weekend and see what happens.
You talk about sleep and dreams in the book, and you say Science Magazine recently reported that sleeping on an issue often results in smarter decisions than overthinking, and especially with important decisions. And I confess I often do this myself because I found it works for me. But you say that this can also help your emotional freedom. How so?
Well, the beauty of dreams, and I'm such a big lover of dreams, I write them down every morning and I look at them and, you know, work with them during the day. But dreams allow you to bypass your ego and the linear mind. Thank God something does. You know, and it allows you to get into your intuitive self. So if you have a dream where you're being chased by a malevolent pursuer on the edge of a mountain and you can't get away, and you wake up and you call this a nightmare, I call this a gift, you know, because what you want to do is turn around and you find out who that pursuer is, who's making you so afraid, so that you can free yourself from them. Your dream is just telling you what your issues, your psychological issues are, but it's up to you to take a look, you know, to turn around. Don't keep running.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look at what your dreams present you, and then you can free yourself from these so-called nightmares. To me, there is no dream that is a nightmare. Every dream is a good dream. Some dreams upset you, but
right.
So what? The point is to awaken you.
And do you believe every dream has a meaning? It's not just maybe something we thought of earlier or saw on television. You think every dream has a meaning of some kind?
Well, I do. I believe everything has a meaning, and I believe that television feeds our dreams. If you want to have a direct experience of your darker side, what I would do is watch the 11 o'clock news before you go to sleep and watch all those murders and killings and then
right.
See what your dream life is. And the next morning, you can see how your dynamic was reflected in the news, how that can really give you an idea of who you are,
mm-hmm.
The dark side.
Mm.
Yeah,
well, I've done it myself. You've done it too, I'm sure. Watched something horrific before you go to sleep and then, you know, had a restless, uneasy night all night long.
Absolutely. I don't advise it, especially for emotional empaths who are so sensitive to energy. You need to listen to music or read poetry or look out at the moon, something sweet before you go to sleep to help ease into the transition between sleep and waking.
Mm.
But if you want to explore your dark side, you watch that news and see what your dreams are.
Now, a lot of people say they can't remember their dreams. So how can that help them when they can't remember them? Or do you actually have suggestions in the book for how to remember them? I wonder if we could look at a couple of those.
Yes, remembering is such a sacred thing. We dream every 90 to 120 minutes. So the point is most people can't remember them. And in the book, I talk about how to remember them. And the way to remember them is to get a dream journal, put it by your bed. You can get a dream pen, which has a little light on the end of it, so you don't have to hassle when you write down your dream. Keep it there every night. Before you go to sleep at night, ask one question, such as, why do I keep attracting men who can't commit? Let's say that's your question.
Mm-hmm.
Or how can I get better health? But just stick to one question, and then go to sleep in the morning for 5 minutes. Do not talk to anybody. And just luxuriate between sleep and waking in the hypnagogic realm. Then write down your answer. Whatever you remember about your dream, it can be a word, it can be a feeling, it can be a whole scenario. Whatever it is, write it down and see how that addresses your question. And only ask one question. Because my patients get into trouble when they always have so much to ask, you know. So many things you want to know.
Yeah, right.
And they ask too many things, so that confuses the answer. So everybody just stick with one question, see how the dream answers it. You could do this every night for a week, and every morning write down your dreams. And once you have to get in the habit of doing this, it's like training your unconscious to do this. So you know, don't dismay if nothing comes the first or second night. It will.
Okay, well, I'm going to try that because I keep dreaming about whales. I'm not quite sure what the significance is there. But, and I'm always afraid I'm going to fall in the pit with them.
But a pit with a whale?
Well, it's like a big lake. It's kind of strange because it's right in the middle of a city, but don't ask me. It's weird.
Everybody, you know, but you just say everybody says that to me. Oh, my dreams are so weird. But don't, you know, the whole archetype of the whale, of getting swallowed up or engulfed by something.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's about, for you, setting boundaries in your life so you don't get swallowed up by whoever is threatening to do that.
I'm glad we talked.
You see how easy it is?
Yeah, it is. When you know.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier a personality. We have personality types. You talked about the empath who absorbs other people's emotions and experiences. And the other is the intellectual. I wonder if we could just look at the downside and upside of both of those.
Oh, yes. Well, it's important to know what your emotional type is. And I just like to say in Body and Soul magazine, in the March issue, they have excerpted this chapter from Emotional Freedom, and it's really great. But it's in Chapter 4 of Emotional Freedom, and I go through what is your emotional type. And the reason you need to know that is so that you can optimize your positive points and you could begin to heal the negative points. And the four types I talk about are the intellectual, the emotional empath, the gusher, and the rock. There are four different types I describe. And the intellectual is, and all of these types have positives and negatives. One type is not better than the other. But the point is you want to achieve balance. But intellectuals are bright and articulate and great analysts, and they're really most comfortable in their mind with a more cerebral approach to emotions. And when stress hits, they often take refuge in their heads as the first line of coping. And so the plus side of the intellectual is they're impeccable analyzers, the great sense of logic. They're comfortable in the world of ideas and abstract thought. They respect what's scientifically proven, and they can stay calm sometimes in heated situations. But the downside of an intellectual is that they may live from the neck up, with difficulty connecting with their own feelings or another person's feelings.
Mm.
So others might see them as cold or withholding or snobby. And you can't really turn your brain off at night. They obsess about problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they may believe in spirituality, but they're hard-pressed to feel it in their soul. And intellectuals often forget to be playful, which is a real downside.
Right.
No. So that is the up and down side of the intellectual. Then the intuitive, the emotional empath. Empaths are highly sensitive, finely tuned instruments when it comes to emotions. I know because I am one, and I have a particular interest in this emotional type because I've had to learn to work with my own sensitivity to absorb energy so I'm not demolished by going out in public and you know, being with people, as I tend to absorb everything.
I read that you once had a boyfriend who bought you a keep out sign for your study.
Right. That was a true sign of love because he understood I needed to get away and he wasn't resentful. Empaths always need to have their own space. And when a partner respects that is an amazing feeling rather than somebody always intruding into your space or implying there's something wrong with you for wanting it. You know, but
right.
Having a partner who can respect your boundaries if you're an empath, that's mana from heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is. But empaths feel everything to an extreme. Intuition is the filter through which they experience the world, and they're naturally giving. But the thing is, the empath's upside is they have a big heart, and they're sensitive, and they feel compassion and experience life fully. The downside is that they're an emotional sponge, and they absorb other people's negativity. And empaths can be so sensitive to emotion, they feel like a wire without insulation. And this is how a lot of my patients have described it.
Interesting. I can see why it's so important to know which side of the fence you fall personality-wise.
Oh, yes, it is, so you can know yourself. And you're not just absorbing energy haphazardly and then feeling depressed or exhausted all the time and not knowing why.
Right, right. So in part two of your book, your tools, you talk about tools for liberation, and you talk about the hands-on approach for facing the seven most prevalent difficult emotions and building positive ones. And the first one you talk about is facing fear and building courage. And I think even though, you know, things are supposedly starting to turn around in the economy and the world, we've all been in that fear mode for so long. I thought it would be useful to run through some of the emotional action steps that you have in the book.
There. Oh, yes. I think it's very useful because it's important to have strategy whenever you feel fear, whether we're going through the economy or whether you're going through a breakup in a relationship, whether you're afraid in a career situation. You need to have strategies to transform fear with courage. Courage is the most powerful thing. To find courage instead of fear, this is something we all need to strive for. And the first thing, I have a fear quiz. You have to ask yourself, how fearful am I? And some of the questions include, do I typically expect the worst in situations? Do fearful thoughts keep me awake at night? Am I afraid to speak up or go for what I want? Am I afraid I won't meet my own or another's expectations? Do other people's fears feel contagious? Is it hard to center myself when I'm afraid? Do I tend to catastrophize about the future? Do I often feel out of contact with the loving spiritual source? So these are all questions to ask yourself how afraid you are. But in terms of strategies, the number one strategy is stay in the now and do not catastrophize about the future.
Mm.
Focus on what you can do for solutions today and what you have to be grateful for today, how you can be of service today, how you can be grateful for the sun and the sky and the friendships and love, and focus your energy on that instead of what's happening tomorrow. That's number one.
Yeah.
And you need to keep reminding yourself of that.
Yeah, definitely. And number two is facing frustration and disappointment and building patience. But I really wanted to look at number three, which is facing loneliness and building connection, because it seems that more and more people are, even with all of the tools that we have to keep us connected, are actually disconnected. So you say we need to attract nurturing connections, and there are five cures for loneliness. And the first one is relationship wish list. I wonder if we could talk about those five cures for loneliness.
There are five cures for loneliness. And what I'd like people to think about is that I'm defining loneliness as not only being without a partner or a social network, it's not being in connection to yourself.
Mm. Yeah, because we can be in a room full of people and still feel lonely, right?
You could be in a relationship and still feel lonely.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's important to realize that loneliness comes from a disconnect with the self and a disconnect with spirit, first and foremost. And as you, throughout a lifetime, can establish that connection with the self, the loving connection with the self, then the loneliness will dissipate. Because sometimes people are lonely not just from what's going on here in the earth realm. It's because they're lonely for their spiritual home. And it's very different in other places in terms of what goes on other than earth, where the sense of love and connection and light beyond which we can conceptualize here is the place from where we all came. And so a lot of times, and I know I feel this in myself, you know, less so recently, but for years, a terrible loneliness to go back to my source, my spiritual source, and to really connect with that. But, you know, I see in terms of my own spiritual path and emotional path, it's to feel at home here and to find through meditation, through connecting with myself, through the love of others, to feel that sense of sublime home here, as well as know that I do have a spiritual home in other places.
Mm. Sounds good. And the other, I'll just read them, facing anxiety and worry, building inner calm, and
yes.
Facing depression. In number four, facing anxiety and worry, building inner calm, how do we reprogram the biology of anxiety? Because I think it's so difficult when if somebody's anxious and used to being in that pattern, how do they reprogram themselves?
Well, you need to take control of your own biology when it comes to this, because you can when you're anxious, what you don't want to do is go towards coffee, sugar, caffeine, stimulants, violent newscast, arguments, or anything like that, because that stimulates the fight or flight response, and that will keep triggering it. And so in times of anxiety, it's important to breathe and center yourself and bring it back down rather than fueling it biologically. And also it's important to stick close to nurturing people.
Yeah.
And not go towards the emotional vampires to suck you dry or get you riled up.
Yeah, and talking of that, you have a great segment on your website about emotional vampires. But we're almost at the end of our segment, so I'm going to run through these real quick. Number five is facing depression, and you replace that by building hope.
Yes.
Number six is facing jealousy and envy, and you transform that by building self-esteem. Number seven is facing anger, and you transform that by building compassion. And you said in the book, I wanted to ask you this, your mother gave you many gifts, including the tenacity to follow your dreams and a love of learning. And I'm wondering how she instilled that in you.
Oh, my mother was my greatest teacher. She encouraged me to be creative and read and learn from people. And we would have conversations, my mother and I, mother and daughter, conversing about everything. She was a doctor, and from the day one, she took me to see patients with her, and I was able to go on house calls with her and see how she listened to patients' hearts and talk to them. And she was my role model with regard to that, and she always encouraged curiosity in me, though not in the intuitive realm. And she was always afraid other people would think I was weird and I wouldn't be accepted.
Right.
But in terms of learning, but my mother was my impetus for writing this book, because she, at age 71, took her medical boards again when she didn't need to and put herself through such self-doubt and stress and self-torture that she had a lymphoma for 20 years that was pretty benign. But because of the stress she put herself under, the lymphoma changed cell type to a malignant leukemia, and it killed her. And so I have tendencies like my mother's in terms of workaholism and inner slave driver and pushing myself. And although the big difference is I'm determined not to let that rule me. And she didn't have the same kind of skills. And so part of my impetus was seeing my mother, what happened to her, and not wanting to go in that direction and wanting to teach others how to avoid letting stress and negativity eat up your very body and soul.
Well, I think the book that you put together here is great. It's not your first book. You've done quite a few, but it's really has a ton of information in the kind you'd keep and refer back to. And I really thank you for being with us today, Dr. Judith Orloff. I know you're coming to Seattle. I want to mention that. It's March 20th. People can register at womenofwisdom.org. Is that correct?
Yes, and it will be at the Unity Church in Seattle at 7 o'clock on Friday, March 20th, and I invite everyone to come and engage in a discussion on emotional freedom, how to overcome fear, how we can join together as a community and be positive. It'll be a great night in Seattle. It's part of my Emotional Freedom book tour.
And let's give out your website, too, because there's a lot of really great information up there. There's a great video up there on Are You Involved with a Narcissist, too?
Right.
So your website is?
It's drjudithorloff.com. That's drjudithorloff.com. And there are all kinds of free articles and free videos and everything free on the website. So lots of information for people.
And the book, again, is called Emotional Freedom, Liberate Yourself from Negative Emotions and Transform Your Life. Dr. Judith Orloff, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Coming up, Vicki talks to actress Rue McClanahan about her memoir, My First Five Husbands and the Ones Who Got Away. That's coming up here on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Stay tuned.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Join us Monday, March 16th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for The Artist as Entrepreneur. The third Monday career series continues with seasoned arts professional Miriam Works. Works is a well-known buyer and business manager for Seattle Galleries and knows firsthand how many talented people fail to get the recognition they deserve. She'll share her business and creative expertise on success and rewards and tell you how to generate income from your arts and crafts. The Artist as Entrepreneur, coming March 16th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for more information.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's The Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss The Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
So, Rue, your book is called My First Five Husbands and the Ones Who Got Away. And I love the opening in your memoir. You say, this book is about my life and experiences as I lived them. And anyone who doesn't like it can jolly well lump it. Was there anything that you were hesitant about writing? You were very candid in the book. Was there anything that you kind of thought, maybe I shouldn't write about that?
No, actually, there wasn't anything I thought I shouldn't write about. There was something that was very hard to write about, which I state in the book, that it's easy to write about the dastardly things done to you. You can even be funny about those. But when it comes to something dastardly that you yourself did to someone whom you think highly of, let's say, which was my case, it's very hard to write, very painful. And I had to take time out on the husband number two, and I really had to walk around the block, literally, several times before I could get back to it.
And that happened such a long time ago. You actually left him, right, husband number two, and but you were very, very good friends with him, and you left him for another man.
He was my best friend up until the day he died in 1994. Yes.
Yeah. Now, you were raised in a small town with a loving family, and I'm always interested in people's beginnings. Even though your family was loving, you say you were totally ill-equipped to cope with angry people such as your first husband or big city theatre life, and yet right from the get-go, you set out to work in one of the toughest professions there is, I think. You arrived in New York, 1957, with 2 weeks' worth of money in your pocket. What gave you the belief in yourself at that tender age to go make this transition?
Oh, I'd always known that I just had to. I just had to. I didn't feel that I had any choice. I really had to earn a place in the theater community. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and you started out dancing. You were dancing before you went there.
Yeah, I'd been doing a lot of dance training, and I'd been teaching dance, so I continued with that, and I also added acting lessons to it. So I was doing acting and dancing, studying and studying and studying, yeah.
Mm. How long were you there before you feel you got your first big break? I know, you know, people will attribute big breaks to you, but what do you feel in yourself was, wow, I'm really starting to make it now?
Well, I was only here, and when I first came right after college, I was only here for January, February, March, April, May, when I got a job at the Erie Playhouse. I got hired to go to the Erie Playhouse for a season of Winter Stock, and that would be a solid job, you know, non-union theater, but still a solid job. I wouldn't be knocking my head against the wall here where I didn't know anybody. And I auditioned for this place and got it, so I went off to do that. And then it was several years later, in 64, that I actually came back to New York. By then, I'd been married a couple of times. I'd been to the Pasadena Playhouse. I'd had a lot of adventures. And when I came back in 64, it was actually, I guess, Norman Lear seeing me in a small off-Broadway play and saying to me, and that was in about 69, so I'd been here about 5 years then, saying, I want to hire you someday. I'm going out west to establish myself as a television producer. And he did. He did All in the Family.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me to come be on All in the Family. And while I was there, he asked if I'd stay and do Maude that he just started. And I did. And that was it. That was the break.
And you had just bought a house in New Jersey. You were set to stay in New Jersey, weren't you, when this all happened for you?
I just bought the house in December, and he called in February and said, we'd like to make this a running role. Do you want to come out? And I'd already done, two appearances on Maude the first year. But he said, now we want to make this a running role. Can you move to California? And I said, well, of course. I just bought my first house here. And I'd be delighted. How soon do you want me?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, was that where you first met Bea Arthur?
Yeah. No, I met her when I was out doing All in the Family and then stayed to do that first appearance on Maude the year before.
Okay. Now, you've done so many movies and plays, so much on Broadway, and I don't know if many of our listeners know this, but I did not know you were also a writer. I didn't know you'd written a screenplay, two musicals, 12 short stories. Multi-talented lady.
Not that I've had them published, you understand. These have not come. They have been written, yes.
Mm.
But I'm planning to get the musical. Well, they've actually been produced. One was done in Burbank for a long run back in 91. But, yes, I'm planning to get those done. But I can't get to them until I've done the one-woman show that's being put together for actually taken from the book and will be called My First Five Husbands.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that's been in the works now for some time. And
right.
It's the one that has everybody, my attention.
Well, you know, you write with, as I said, such candor, but you also some humility. You're not pretentious at all in this book, and a lot of humor. Your humor's got you through a lot of very tough situations, right?
Yes, and I never expected to be a funny actress. I just expected to be an actress.
Mm. I was saying how many credits you have, but we can't not mention the Golden Girls, of course. And I did see you in an interview where you said you can't watch the Golden Girls because it's so nostalgic for you.
Well, that might have been true when I said that in that interview. It's no longer true.
Okay.
I've moved beyond it now to the book and now to this new Broadway experience that we're planning. And, no, I find the Golden Girls delightful to watch. It's, I tell you, the hardest part is saying, oh, I didn't get that costume. Oh, I didn't get that costume. Because some of them were just so wonderful, and I only could take a pickup full.
Only a pickup full.
A pickup load. I had a pickup, and I still have so many of those costumes that, you know, I need to rent a new apartment to keep them in.
Mm.
I have room in California, but not here.
I can believe it. Well, your book is called My First Five Husbands and the Ones Who Got Away. I want to talk about a day that I imagine must be one of the most bittersweet days of your life, and that was on the day that you were actually diagnosed with breast cancer. But it was also the day that your sixth husband first told you he loved you.
That's right.
What was that experience like for you?
The first part, being told that I had breast cancer, I almost fainted. I got very weak, and I was reeling off the table, and the doctor caught me. And then a few minutes later, I was out in the lobby, and Mauro told me he loved me. And, of course, that was what I'd been wanting to hear for, I'd only known him 2.5 weeks.
Oh.
I wanted to hear for 2.5 weeks.
Right, right. But then he proposed just a few days later after that, right?
He claims that he proposed. I claim that I proposed.
And you guys have been together ever since. So you say you describe him as your soulmate. You actually said at one point, if I can just find that, you said that there were many times when you truly wondered, you asked yourself, Lord, will I ever get it right? Do you feel you've got it right now?
Yes. Yes, I feel that he and I together have got it right. And we plan for this to be both of our last marriages.
Mm.
This is it.
Yeah. Now, you talked about your play that you want to get going. When do you anticipate your one-man play will be coming out?
Well, right now, we're thinking about going into rehearsal April 1st. It's being written. A lot of the music is being put together. A lot of the script is being done. And it's an extremely ambitious piece of theater that the producer has, a marvelous man named Michael LaRue, has envisioned. He's concocted this in his head, and it's quite unique in that it starts at the end of the book and goes backwards to the first, well, it actually goes back to my childhood.
Mm.
So, and it's multimedia. It has a great many, in fact, it has as many effects as you can imagine, and I'm saying really 21st century stuff that hasn't been done on a Broadway stage before. Some of this has been done in Sundays in the Park with George, but not to the extent that Michael has planned to do it in our show.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Well, you've had so many accomplishments, Rue. What are you most proud of?
Oh, my son.
Your son.
My son, Mark. He's doing some of the music for the show. He's an extremely gifted artist in jazz music. He plays jazz guitar, and he teaches guitar in Austin, Texas. And he has written all the themes for the five husbands. Each one has a theme.
A separate theme. Mm-hmm.
And he's also written the beautiful music for a song called Mark's Song, or Little One, that actually ends the first act. We've gone back to his childhood by that point, and it's a gorgeous song. Cameron and Lively have written the lyrics to it. Julia Cameron Lively. Anyway, Emma. Emma Lively.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Is that Julia Cameron from The Artist's Way?
Yes, it is.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They are a musical team. They write music and lyrics for their own musicals. And they put together about 10, 12 songs for this. And then Mark has put together the five theme songs. And he's written this gorgeous guitar, very plaintive melody for Mark's song.
Well, I will look forward to seeing that when it comes out. I want to ask, because you've played so many different characters, if people have known you from your work and then they got to know you on a personal level, what do you think would most surprise them about you?
That I'm nothing like Blanche Devereaux. That's what surprises everybody.
Well, yeah.
I'm really not Blanche Devereaux. I've played so many parts, but that's my most famous role, because of the success of that show just going on and on forever.
Yeah.
And so kids who weren't even born when we started it in 1985 are now watching it, and they think it's new because, you know, it's sort of timeless the way they wrote it. It just really holds up so well. But, and that was a very memorable role, and I'm so glad to have done it. But that isn't me. That's a part I played.
Right. Well, I think the fact that people do think you're like that is a testament to how well you played the part.
Well, thank you. And I hope that the book has disabused a lot of people of that impression.
Yes.
Because that I'm really pretty grassroots and down to earth and quite a different person from Miss Devereaux.
Right. We're almost at the end of our segment, unfortunately. What do you know now that you wish you had known 20 years ago?
I wish I'd known about standing back and saying, let me think that over before I say yes to something, to anything, particularly marriage. And I wish I'd known about, well, if I'd known that, I think I wouldn't have gotten into so much hot water. But I wish I'd known that patience is a virtue to be embraced, and forbearance, and you really have to hang in there if you're going to make a relationship work. But first of all, it has to be a relationship that can work.
Mm.
And had I stood back and said, wait a minute, don't stampede me into this thing, because I was needy. I wish I'd known that being needy is no reason, is no place to start a relationship from.
Right.
You have to be your own person, strong and sure of yourself, and as canny as you can be. And don't let people make you think that you have to have this person in your life or you'll die. And speaking of whom, here comes my husband through the door. Hello, darling.
Well, tell him hello from us.
Hello, says, what's your name, sweetheart?
It's Vicky.
Yes, hello, says Vicky.
Well, I certainly have enjoyed talking with you today, and I know my mother, for one, is going to really enjoy this segment because she's a huge fan of the body of your work over the years, and I certainly appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, I like the way you put that. She's not just a Golden Girls fan.
No, you're actually about the same age, so she kind of grew up with you. So.
Oh. Well, tell her hello from me. Hello there from me.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
You would see the biggest gift would be for me, and the card attached would say thank you for being a friend. And if you threw a party, invited everyone you knew, you would see the biggest gift would be for me, and the card.
When someone asks, what do you do, how do you answer? If you want to stand out in the crowd and have people remember you when you're networking, you must have a great opening line. It's often called your elevator speech, and every entrepreneur and business professional needs a clear, concise, and memorable conversation starter. Well, Lorraine Howell was a guest on our show in January. She's a former television producer and media skills training expert, and she's offering personalized classes for people who need to boost their networking and conversational skills. Workshops are limited to just 4 people for these half-day sessions, so they're very intimate. Very focused on your specific needs. I attended one and know firsthand that Lorraine really knows her stuff. She's a great facilitator and wants you to leave the class feeling good about starting your next networking conversation. She even provides a free follow-up telecall to make sure your elevator speech works for you. For more information and class schedules, visit Lorraine Howell's www.mediaskillstraining.com. That's mediaskillstraining.com.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Forget their space and come check out our space on the web, 1150kknw.com, and find out about Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Vicki returns live next week with guest Miriam Works. Be sure and stay tuned for more information on that. But first, we want to mention that you can leave Vicki voicemail at 206-425-6159. She loves to hear your comments, or you can email Vicki at info@conversationslive.net or call 800-495-7617. Join us Monday, March 16th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for The Artist as Entrepreneur. The Third Monday Career Series continues with seasoned arts professional Miriam Works. Works is a well-known buyer and business manager for Seattle Galleries and knows firsthand how many talented people fail to get the recognition they deserve. She'll share her business and creative expertise on success and rewards and tell you how to generate income from your arts and crafts. The Artist as Entrepreneur, coming March 16th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for more information.